That was Ben Webster opening up today's Fresh Air with his recording of 1 o'clock Jump. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll hear from novelist Robert Stone. Stone considers himself a product of the 60s. He writes novels that crystallize the times and the impact of current events on the American psyche. His novel, The Dog Soldiers, won a National Book Award. It was about the violence of the war in Vietnam returning home to America, and it described the dark, potentially psychotic side of the counterculture and the drug scene of the early 70s. Stone's novel, A Flag for Sunrise, was about four Americans in a Central American country on the brink of revolution. His new novel, Children of Light, is set in Hollywood. The movies WUSA and Who'll Stop the Rain are both adapted from novels by Stone, but he was unhappy with both of the movies. We'll talk about his life and his writing at 4 o'clock. At 3:30, we'll hear a documentary on the continuing debate over the Roman Catholic Church's ban on the ordination of women. England is facing an obscenity trial, which the London Times called the biggest case of its sort since the obscenity charge involving D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1960. My guest, Ed Hermance of Philadelphia, is named as a co-conspirator for smuggling indecent or obscene materials to London's leading gay bookstore, Gay's the Word. Hermance co-owns Giovanni's Room, Philadelphia's leading gay and feminist bookstore. Hermance also exports gay and feminist literature. The obscenity case dates back to April of 1984, when British authorities searched Gay's the Word bookstore and the homes of the store's staff and directors. Using the powers of customs and excise to prohibit indecent or obscene articles, they seized 144 imported titles. They later released 68 of those titles, but the remaining 76 are currently banned from import in England. The trial is scheduled to begin October 6th. Ed Hermance interprets this case as discrimination against gay books. We called the British Embassy and Her Majesty's Customs and Excise in London. They declined to comment on the air on this case or on the law applied to the case. But a British Embassy spokesperson did say that the issue behind the case is obscenity, not homosexuality. Giovanni's Room has organized a benefit on the occasion of the second anniversary of the raid on Gay's the Word bookstore. The benefit is to raise money to send Ed Hermance and literary witnesses to London to testify on the trial scheduled to begin October 6th of this year. The benefit will be held Thursday, April 10th, from 2 until 7 o'clock at Giovanni's Room on 12th and Pine Streets in Philadelphia. The guests will include Felice Picano, who's a publisher of several of the C's books and the author of one of them, and Charles Silverstein, co-author of The Joy of Gay Sex and Man to Man, both are C's books. The phone number for more information is 923-2960. That's 923-2960. Ed Hermance, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with your exportation. It's kind of surprising that a relatively small bookstore, you're not a chain or anything, you're a bookstore in Center City, Philadelphia, and you're exporting books to England. How did you get involved with that?
Because we're a specialty bookstore in feminist and lesbian and gay books, then we got interested in trading with other bookstores overseas. And about 6 years ago, we made contact with Gay's the Word, which may have been 1 or 2 years older at that time. And they bought so many books from us that we ended up opening a wholesale business to distribute. And now we send to about 125 bookstores overseas. And the reason that there was this hole in the market is that because they are specialty books, though it's hard to think that feminist books would be a specialty category, but they are, that the usual international distributors are not good at stocking those books. And so virtually all of the important gay and feminist bookstores around the world buy from us because we collect all of those books in one place. And Gay's the Word was our principal customer for a long time and until 2 years ago. And when the raid came on April the 10th in 84, then that really took away about a third of our wholesale business in one fell swoop.
Let's go back to that raid 2 years ago this month. Can you describe what you know of the search and seizure at the bookstore and the homes of staff members of the bookstore?
It was possible because of the peculiarities of British law that, in the United States, you would need some sort of a search warrant and such like that, or supervision of some sort of a court. But British law allows the customs officials to really do anything they want for as long as they want. an Englishman was in the store today who said that...
In Gage the Word?
In our store today, saying that he had man-to-man, which was just seized last month by British Customs. And I didn't tell him, but it's possible that if the customs knew that he had that book in his house, they could go and get it without any search warrant, without anything, of just that the book was an imported obscene book, and therefore they could go get it. So we found out about the raid by a telephone call from Gaze the Word saying that the customs officials had been there for 6 hours. They had taken the manager of the store off to headquarters, and she was questioned for 4 hours without benefit of counsel. They went to the homes of all of the directors of the store and took a lot of personal possessions. That is, you know, one man is a scholar. He has probably 10,000 books in his house. And they went through that whole collection and took whatever they wanted to. They took all of the records of the bookstore, you know, their checkbooks, their order books, everything. So that, you know, for 6 months, they imagine trying to operate a business without any paperwork at all, of having any idea of what you had ordered and so on, of trying to reconstruct all of that information. So, you know, my general impression is that it's a bureaucratic operation, that they are not concerned with how it affects people or even how there's no judgment about how serious it is. After they got the books carted off, they had 36 people reading these books for 9 months. You know, taking notes on every time a four-letter word appeared in some book or other, then they made a note of it, and then they produced a schedule of obscene passages from these books. And, you know, I think it would be very difficult to go to any American bookstore or British bookstore, for that matter, and to look through the books and not find a four-letter word somewhere. And so, you know, and all of this, again, is possible because of the peculiarities of the British law, that the law originally was written in 1876. And what the Parliament was thinking of at that time was that someone was sending erotic chess sets from Paris to British girls' boarding schools. And so they wanted a law that would allow them to prevent those chess sets from being imported. So it's the law is phrased as indecent or obscene materials. And what they're thinking about are objects, really. But in, you know, how things accrete on top of that law, then in the interpretations of customs administration as it's come down through the years, then one of the customs officials testified in the hearing this last summer that he had been instructed to detain anything that mentioned lesbianism or homosexuality. And so that's what he did. And he testified that he would continue to do so as long as, until somebody told him the contrary, that he wasn't supposed to do that.
Can you give us an idea of the range of the books that were seized, and especially the range of books that are still considered obscene and that can't be imported in England?
Mm-hmm. Well, of the 76, there should be divided into two categories. There are eight titles that are mentioned specifically in the conspiracy charges, and then there are, what is the remainder of that, is like 68 books that are not mentioned specifically in the conspiracy charges, but they are nevertheless held, they were all declared indecent or obscene, and they are all part of the evidence of this so-called conspiracy. And the books that are in the most important section, the eight, are The Joy of Gay Sex and The Joy of Lesbian Sex. And those are actually the two books on which this whole case is founded.
I should mention that The Joy of Gay Sex is co-authored by two people who you might have heard on Fresh Air if you're not familiar with the book. One of them is Edmund White, who's been here several times to discuss his novels. And the other is Charles Silverstein, who was on the show several years ago to discuss his book about Family Matters. Yeah, uh-huh. And it was about the reaction of parents whose children have come out, and it's a guide for both children and for parents about dealing with homosexuality in the family. Mm-hmm. Anyways,
and one of the ironies of that seizure is that the original Joy of Sex and More Joy of Sex books, as well as these two, were packaged by a British company. That is, you know, instead of authors just abstractly writing a book and submitting it to a publisher, then there are companies that make up package books, that they get the artists together and they get the authors together. And the people that did that are all British. though The Joy of Gay and Joy of Lesbian were never published in Britain. They were only published here. But they are really exactly comparable to the heterosexual volumes, that, you know, they're no more obscene or less obscene than the heterosexual volumes. So there are those two. Another of the Big Eight is a New York native, two issues of that newspaper, which is a weekly paper published, you know, very much in the sort of style of the Philadelphia Gay News or of any big city gay newspaper. And the thing that distinguishes it from the other gay papers is that from the very beginning of the AIDS crisis, it has produced on a weekly basis massive amounts of information. There may be a lot of arguing with their editorial stances and such like that on the AIDS crisis, but there's no question at all that they have been the best source of public information on a regular basis for the gay community.
So the information contained in the New York Native can now not be read in England because publication can't get
exported. That's right. We are the international distributor of that newspaper, and we have not sent any copies in over 2 years now. And you know, it does have, I don't know exactly what Customs found offensive in that. There are ads in the way that virtually all counterculture newspapers have, sex ads of one sort or another, of looking for partners and such like that. That may have been what they objected to. But nevertheless, there's that kind of overwhelming importance to the magazine. That, and just in connection with that, you know, it's as though the AIDS information, they're not going to let through. In the United States, the response of a lot of gay men to that AIDS crisis is to try to develop couple relationships. And that has led to a boom in the sales of books like The Male Couple and this Man to Man, which is a psychological counseling book. And now the British have banned the couple book. So not only don't they want you to know about AIDS, but they don't want you to know about how to be a couple, too. You know, of course, none of this is conscious. This is just the effects of this bureaucratic operation it's really, my impression is that it's completely out of control, that the British ambassador, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who is in charge of customs, and customs officials all deny that there is any discrimination against gay subject matter. But, you know, when you have a marriage counseling book for heterosexuals, there's no one, there hasn't been any case about that. There, so far as I know, there have been no major book seizures since 1960. And the D.H. Lawrence book, and all of these things. Just another example is the customs official testified this last summer that he detained a book because it had a blurb on the back of it by Christopher Isherwood, and he knew that Isherwood was a homosexual, and so that, you know, that was a clue to him that he should detain this. And that it's in the book that he detained is called Treasures on Earth. Ironically, it was first published in Britain. It was out of print there. It was published in the United States, and we sent some copies. It's published by Alfred Knopf, who is one of the most respected publishers of American contemporary fiction. It's a historical novel based on a Yale scientific expedition to Peru in 1912, and this expedition accidentally discovered Machu Picchu. The tale is told from the point of view of the photographer for this expedition, and who calls himself a Uranian, which is, you know, a 1912 word for homosexuals. And again, it's a serious novel. There are sexual passages in the novel, but has anyone read an American novel published in the last 50 years that did not have anything to do with sex. You know, and again, the British law can allow for this sort of thing because there is no defense for merit. That if there is one of those four-letter words in there, then they can seize it because that is indecent or obscene, and there is no defense by saying this is a medical information or anything else.
This is a very celebrated case in England now, and all the literary magazines and supplements are talking about it as the most important case since Lady Chatterley's Lover or Hubert Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn. What's the reaction in England? What are the publishers and the bookstores and literary community doing?
Well, I haven't had an update in probably 6 months, but major British publishers have contributed to the defense funds, like Penguin and Chatto and Windus and Gollancz, others. Probably most Americans haven't heard of these, but they are like the cream of the British publishing industry. The Sir Angus Wilson, some of whose novels we carry because they have gay content, and he is the head president of the Royal Society for Literature or something like that, has made very strong statements in our support. The Publishers Association in Britain has given strong support. Of course, the bookseller industry in general has supported us.
What about in America? Are you getting support from American publishers whose books are now banned from England?
Some. I'm actually very disappointed that most of the small people, the presses who don't publish more than 15 or 20 books a year, so that they're, you know, all their interest is maybe 60 or 80 books. Those people have been very supportive of us, of, you know, writing and giving money and giving books and so on. Major publishers are, they're very uncertain. They are afraid that, well, they don't want to offend the British by defending their own books, which is a point of view I find difficult to understand. That I would think that Alfred Knopf should send the British a letter saying that this is ridiculous to call our novel an obscene book and destroy it, which is what happens to these books. But, you know, I suppose the thing is that they feel like they would have to invest so much time finding out about the case that and then they might be wrong at the end, and that they would just prefer to stand back and watch and let the trial happen. You know, if those people are sent to jail for 2 years, I intend to talk to each of those publishers, and, you know, is more strongly than I have in the past, you know, that they have done really very little to support us.
My guess is Ed Hermans, who co-owns Giovanni's Room, the Center City, Philadelphia gay and lesbian bookstore, and he's currently indicted in England on charges of co-conspiracy to smuggle in indecent or obscene literature. And what it is that he exports gay and feminist books to several countries, and he exchanges books with London's leading gay bookstore. And many books were confiscated there, and they're books that have homosexual content in it. Many of them have sex scenes in it, but many of them are psychological counseling type books or newspapers or magazines. Let's get back to you, Ed. Now, you're charged as a co-conspirator here. What could be the consequences for you? Say the whole group is found guilty. What would that mean?
I don't really know. That I got a letter from the British ambassador this week saying that he had made inquiries at customs to find out if I would be arrested if I were to go to England. And customs says they don't know.
So if you go to England to testify in the trial and you're found guilty, you might not come back for a couple of years.
Well, I might be arrested when I entered the country, as no one knows.
Well, are the people from Gage the Word in jail now?
No, they are not in jail.
But had been in jail and they were released?
No, they haven't been. Well, they have been questioned. They've been held for questioning, but they haven't actually been arrested. Well, I'm not sure about that. They're charged, so they must have been arrested in some sense of the word.
But you're afraid when you get off the airplane, you might be arrested.
That's right. It might happen. And the National Council for Civil Liberties in England, which is representing Gays the Word, is trying to extract some sort of a promise from customs that they will not arrest me. But, you know, I haven't heard any news about that. That's, and they have been trying to do that for 6 months at least. So.
So do you want to go under
yes,
the circumstances?
I would love to go.
You're going to take that chance.
The trial is going to be in the Old Bailey where WHYY's fans of Horace Rumpole have seen all of that lovely woodwork. I would love to testify in that dock. And, too, I think that, you know, when people hear the words that, oh, there's an obscenity case or something like that, then there are all these dark people who are, you know, evil in some way. I think it's very important to show them that, you know, if we're, you know, we're reasonably intelligent and responsible people and want to... you know, that this case is really absurd.
What kind of effect, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but what kind of effect do you think that this case is having on the gay community in England and in America, people here who are following what's happening in England?
It's difficult to know. You know, and one impression that I have is that this is just a bureaucratic mess, that certain customs officials started working on this case and they decided that there were a few books that they didn't like and then it snowballed. At the same time, in England, you know, the police have in the last year or so taken to writing down license tags, numbers of people who are parked near to gay bars in London. Of course, who knows whether whose cars their license, you know, tags they're taking down. You know, they may or may not be gay just because they're parked near to a gay bar. I don't think that there's, you know, in general, the social atmosphere is significantly different in England than it is here. But it's obviously it raises a lot of pressure on the gay community of having to raise thousands and thousands of dollars to fight a trial like this when, you know, all they're going to, if they win, they're just back to where they started from. And so, you know, and on the other hand, perhaps the struggle itself is a unifying factor and that, you know, the issues will be clearer in people's heads. And maybe if, regardless of the outcome of this case, somehow there will be change of the British laws that will allow, you know, British published books have, you can defend them on the merit of the case. And some of the books that were seized in our case have since been published in Britain with no difficulties at all, though they are still evidence in this trial of a conspiracy.
So if I'm interpreting you correctly, you're really not sure now whether the English government would like to see these books remain declared obscene or whether they're kind of embarrassed by the way the whole thing has been handled and they'd like to...
I'm completely baffled by their situation. Mm-hmm. They have had plenty of opportunities to withdraw.
They have,
And they say the right things, like the British ambassador, like the Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know, that there's no question of discrimination against homosexuality. They say the right things, but then the practice is blatantly opposed to what the theory is. So I really don't know what their intentions are.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us about this case and your involvement in it. My guest has been Ed Hermance, and he runs Giovanni's Room Bookstore. He co-owns the bookstore in Center City, Philadelphia, and it's the leading gay and feminist bookstore in the city. He has been charged as a co-conspirator in smuggling obscene or indecent literature into England, and he exports gay and feminist literature, and many of those books were seized from London's leading gay bookstore, Gay's the Word, and the books range from novels to counseling books. The Joy of Gay Sex is one of the books. The New York Native is a publication that's still seized, and that's a gay newspaper from out of New York. There's a benefit to raise money to send Ed Hermance and literary witnesses to London to testify in the trial, which is scheduled to begin October 6, 1986. And in England, the trial is being referred to as perhaps the most important obscenity case since D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. The benefit will be held Thursday, April 10th from 2 until 7 o'clock at Giovanni's Room at 12th and Pine Streets. And the guest speakers will be Felice Picano, who has published several of the seized books and has authored one of them, and Charles Silverstein, who is a psychologist and co-author of The Joy of Gay Sex and Man to Man, both of which are seized books. For more information about the benefit, you can call 923-2960. That's 923-2960. Ed Hermance, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's 28 minutes after 3. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. At 4 o'clock today, we're going to hear from novelist Robert Stone. Right now, we're going to hear a documentary on the ongoing debate over the ban on women's ordination in the Roman Catholic Church. We'll hear from women who want to be priests and from traditional church women who support the Pope and from a bishop caught between both groups. This documentary was produced by Anne Bolin, who produced the film With Babies and Banners, and Celeste Wesson, who worked at NPR for 5 years as national editor and producer of Weekend All Things Considered.
The Power and the Spirit is funded by the District of Columbia Community Humanities Council, the District of Columbia Commission on the Arts and the Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund. It was produced by the Power and the Spirit Radio Project, which is solely responsible for its content.
We're seeing how a mighty wind sweeps the surging waters, Spirit moving where she will, birthing the light from darkness. Oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, moving within your daughters.
The Power and the Spirit, the story of women who want to be priests in the Roman Catholic Church.
Telling a story never told, nations to justice leading. Oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, moving within your daughters. Oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, oh, Spirit moving, moving within your daughters.
I have the Master of Divinity. I have the Master of Sacred Theology. The only thing that's not there is that I happen to have the wrong body.
Several hundred women say they are called by God to be priests in the Roman Catholic Church. As priests, they could perform the central sacraments of the church and would be part of the decision-making hierarchy. But the church, unlike many Christian denominations, does not ordain women.
Ordination is the tip of the iceberg. If women are refused, that says something about the seriousness with which the church takes women's role and leadership and experience at every single other level of the church.
In the past decade, a Catholic women's movement has grown up, calling for many changes in the church. It includes a network of alternative worship groups called Women Church, which recognizes Catholic women as priests.
I have never felt that because I can't be a priest that I've been excluded from the church. The Holy Father has reiterated over and over they cannot. As a Catholic, that's all you need.
In response, another Catholic women's movement has started. Women who don't want the church to change, who remain loyal to traditional teaching about women's role.
I always gathered my friends, whether they were Catholic or Protestant, for spiritual events. I was the one who organized the neighborhood, and we had May altars in one another's homes, processed up and down the street, adoring, gathered for funerals of dead animals. And those are some of my earliest memories of celebrating liturgies.
When Diane New was a little girl in Beech Grove, Indiana, she liked pretending that she was a priest. And she liked going to Holy Name Parish Church with her mother.
When I was 8 years old, in front of the altar of the Blessed Mother, wearing my peach dress and reddish-colored shoes, I remember vividly feeling that I was called to do something special in my life, that I'd be doing some kind of work that would be important to God.
10 years later, Diane New entered the Sisters of Providence. She didn't know then that she really wanted to be a priest, to lead the worship services, the liturgies she loved so much. Women served God by being mothers or nuns. For 2,000 years, only celibate men had ever been priests. It was one of the unbroken traditions of the church. Then, in the early 1960s, Pope John XXIII called all the bishops to Rome for the first Vatican Council in 400 years. The goal of Vatican II? To bring the church into the modern world. Rosalie Michelle Reinhardt was raising four children in Spencerport, New York, and teaching a religion class for children.
When Vatican II happened, I was one of those people who literally ran to the post office in the small town in which we lived to get the Catholic paper. I always said I read Xavier Ryan's letters when the print was still wet. What is going on?
The dispatches from Rome were electrifying. The church would not be set apart. It would be in the world, as Jesus was, working for the poor and oppressed. The Mass would be in the language people understood, not Latin. Sisters could wear street clothes instead of medieval habits. Women were allowed behind the communion rail, not just to change the altar linens, but to read during services. And the council said the Holy Spirit worked through everyone in the church, not just priests and bishops. The changes frightened and disturbed some Catholics, but Rosalie Reinhardt embraced the new church, and she wanted more. Even though the church had said nothing about ordaining women, she enrolled in 1968 in the Jesuit seminary in Chicago. She was the first woman to go there.
I sat in a class of seminarians for 2 weeks, and no one said hello. And I used to drive home and say, they're being trained to be priests, and they don't even say hello.
In seminary, Rosalie studied theology and church history. She discovered that many church thinkers had attitudes toward women which disturbed her deeply.
A funny thing happened to me in seminary. When I studied theology, I became a feminist. And the one image I have of myself, the hours that I would be in the library, weeping from the bottom of my feet. It is true. They hate us. One cannot read the early church fathers and come up with any conclusion, but they hate us.
In the early 1970s, Diane New was teaching at a convent high school run by the Order of Sisters she had joined. It was then she began to think about priesthood.
Early on, when I was teaching religion and when I was working with liturgy services, I began to realize that, in fact, I too was called, and I too had the gifts that were God-given gifts to celebrate the Mass, to celebrate the liturgy.
After Vatican II, sisters and lay people could help plan and even hold worship services, although it wasn't really a Mass unless a priest was there. Diane, as a nun, even led services with her students using the traditional symbols.
It was around the time of Easter, and I was actually using bread and grape juice, for them grape juice since they were freshmen, in a form of a prayer service. And the bell rang for the change of classes and nobody would move. And it was very clear that something sacred had happened in that room. And I went away from that class and said to myself, Diane, you know what's happening, and you better start taking it seriously.
What Diane did was enter a seminary to study for the priesthood. By the 1970s, dozens of women enrolled in seminaries each year, believing that priesthood for Catholic women was a possibility. The Episcopal Church had recently allowed women to be ordained, and there was a shortage of men who wanted to be Catholic priests.
Women in the church ought to seek ordination. They should seek it without bitterness.
In 1975, supporters of ordination for women held a conference in Detroit. No one thought that 1,200 people would come.
Because now ripens the time when they must say to the church words reminiscent of the words of Jesus Christ to his disciples, under the continued query for a revelation of his true reality. Have we been so long with you, and you have not known us?
When Margaret Farley, who's in ethics and teaches at Yale, ended her talk with, can we women say of the church, we have been so long with you, and you don't even know us? That broke open that conference, and the crying and the weeping was almost too much to bear.
Soon after, the Women's Ordination Conference opened their first office. They identified 500 women who said they were called to priesthood. Local groups started across the country. And in Rome, Pope Paul VI asked a committee of scholars to study the question of women priests. Then, in 1977, the Declaration. The church would not break with tradition.
Father, you founded your church on the apostles to stand firm forever. We join with the hosts of heaven in their triumphant song. Holy, holy, holy Lord, God of power and might, heaven and earth are full of...
Bishop James Malone heads the National Conference of Catholic Bishops.
The church position is that women are not to be ordained priests because priests are to image Christ Jesus, who was a male.
The Vatican Declaration said that the priest should be easy to recognize as a symbol of Christ and therefore must be male. The Declaration gave a second reason. Bishop Joseph Immisch chairs a panel writing a pastoral letter on women.
I think it has been church understanding that Jesus initiated priesthood and called the apostles to that work in the church. We believe that that was not something simply cultural or societal, but it was indeed the mind of Jesus that men would be called.
The Declaration stunned the women who were hoping to be ordained. They thought the priests should represent Jesus' character, not his gender. They said they did not believe that Jesus, by appointing men as apostles, meant to exclude women priests forever. And they cited the importance of women in the early church, quoting a verse from Scripture, "Neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Then they turned a critical eye on the church that refused them. Madonna Kolbenschlag is a sister of the Humility of Mary. She teaches at the Woodstock Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C.
I think one of the things that is really holding the church back is sexuality. The way in which the church deals with issues that in any way touch sexuality, it just echoes the ancient teachings on women, you know, as sunk in their emotionality and in nature and not in control of themselves and therefore a danger to man and beast alike.
Diane knew.
The problem is that the men have the decision-making power in the church. And in order for a fresh life to come to the church right now, there must be a sharing of the decision-making powers with women and men together.
Rosemary Radford Ruther is a Catholic feminist theologian who teaches at a Methodist seminary in Illinois. She says that excluding women from equal power in the church is a sin.
Any kind of dehumanization of other people is a sin. And the sin gets worse if you set up an institutional structure that has as its very intent deprivation of people of fullness of life. The sin gets even bigger when you claim that that's the natural order of things that can't be changed. And it gets worst of all if you claim that God desires it.
A year after the Declaration, in 1978, there was a new pope.
As we prepare to celebrate the mystery of Christ's law, let us acknowledge our failures and ask the Lord for pardon and strength.
Lord Jesus. In 1979, Pope John Paul II came to the United States and visited six cities. In Washington, he spoke to a group of 2,000 nuns. The sister who greeted him was the head of the Sisters of Mercy, Teresa Kane, small, with a sweet round face and silver hair, wearing a business suit, not a habit. She was the only woman except for the president's wife who had a chance to address the Pope publicly. Millions of people saw her on television that night. She stood before him under the vaulted ceiling of the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception.
As I share this privileged moment with you, Your Holiness, I urge you to be mindful of the intense suffering and pain which is part of the life of many women in these United States. As women, we have heard the powerful messages of our church. Our contemplation leads us to state that the church, in its struggle to be faithful to its call for reverence and dignity for all persons, must respond by providing the possibility of women as persons being included in all ministries of our church.
The Pope did not respond to her unprecedented public confrontation. Later, he reaffirmed the ban on women priests. And since then, he has warned American bishops not to encourage women's ordination.
Had the bishops ordained us, a long time ago, they probably would have been able to control us. But now, there is no way, because we are not women, we are feminists who want to be priests.
Women began to say they did not need approval from the church fathers to be priests. They said they were priests already. The growing visibility of women who wanted to change the church inspired women who wanted it to stay the same. In the early 1980s, they began to organize.
Morning.
Helen Hull Hitchcock is raising three daughters in a comfortable house on a tree-lined St. Louis street. She's active in the parish and sends her kids to Catholic schools. A picture of her with the Pope sits in the front corner of the living room. She writes a column for a conservative Catholic weekly.
If the only information we got was from what we see on television, we would think that all Catholic women were desperately unhappy with the Catholic Church and felt that it was an oppressive patriarchal institution. Now, I knew, and obviously many other people knew, that this was not a just picture.
So when the bishops decided to write a pastoral letter on women in 1984, Helen helped start a new group. They called themselves Women for Faith and Family.
Half a dozen of us got together around my dining room table in there to discuss the possibility of circulating some kind of document which would explicitly affirm the teachings of the Catholic Church, and especially loyalty to Pope John Paul II, who was increasingly being criticized by the women whom you read about in the media.
Ask her, maybe she could write this letter or something similar
to the bishops.
Every Thursday, Women for Faith and Family meet to open and answer the mail. Yeah. Helen claims that 25,000 women have signed the petition.
Here's a really good letter. It says, Dear Madam, I'd like to add my signature to a list you are sending to the Pope. In case you're wondering, I'm 34, single, and a career woman, and also sick and tired of the ultra-liberal feminists who claim to represent me and say the majority of Catholic women want abortion, women priests, and heaven knows what else.
We know that women are quite capable of doing all of the things that an ordinary priest does. What they cannot do is to represent Christ to the people of God.
Helen supports the church position against women's ordination because she agrees with another church position. Men and women have equal but different roles in life.
Our sexuality very strongly relates to who we are as human beings, because women participate with God in His divine creativity by our ability to bear within our bodies a new human life. That makes a difference in the way we look at life.
Joan Donahue runs workshops to teach conservative Catholics how to get their views across in the church hierarchy. The Catholic Center, where she works in Washington, D.C., is an offshoot of Paul Weyrich's Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. She says the women who want priesthood misinterpreted Vatican II.
Always reform is good. And yet what it was the opening for people who did not like some of the things about the Catholic Church to say, good, let's just change all these things and throw away all the old things and have all these new things. Well, what they did was throw away the baby with the bathwater.
Joan says that the basic truth of the church doesn't change, and that gives stability to her life.
That's why I'm so glad to be a Catholic. I don't have to search it through. I always ask my friends of different denominations, well, who do you go to if you have a conflict? Let's say you and your husband have a conflict over contraception. Who sets the final answer? Nobody does in those churches. I'm glad that God provided the vehicle so I can know, because it makes my life a lot more peaceful.
And she says that those who disagree with the Pope's teaching should consider leaving the church.
If you want to stay in the club, I think, you can't do what those people are doing. What they're saying is, we don't want to listen to what Rome says. We want to form our own opinions. But listen, we're in the Catholic Church still. And the reason they're doing it is because the Catholic Church has a lot of clout and a lot of credibility and money. What they want is the tag of Catholicism for the credibility without any of the responsibility.
The women who want to be priests have no desire to leave the church. They do not agree that Catholicism is like a club with rigid rules, and they defend their interpretation of Vatican II. Georgetown University's Madonna Kolbenschlag.
If we believe the theology of the church that we now have, then you can't help but come to the point where you say, this is my church too, and I will not let anyone take it away from me.
Some of the women who want the church to change have spent decades serving it as nuns. Others simply can't imagine not being Catholic.
I think people don't understand that just as I cannot say I am no longer a Russian, German, American, I also can never say I am not Catholic. I can't give that up, just as I can't give up my ethnicity.
Rosalie Reinhardt adds that she thinks it is her responsibility to change the church. She's a grandmother now, living in Rochester, New York, teaching high school girls at the Nazareth Academy. She's been active in the women's ordination movement for more than a decade.
One time when I was at a bishop's meeting, and it was like 7 o'clock at night, and this was a bishop that I knew, and he came out and he said, oh, are you still here? And it was really a compassionate, it's late at night, and I looked at him and I said, oh, bishop, we're never going to go away, just never.
For some women, the answer is women church. Still Catholic, but not official, rooted in the tradition, but trying hard to change it, women church is a few hundred groups of women and men meeting to worship with one another in living rooms like this one in the Midwest.
Oh, welcome, Kathy.
Perhaps two dozen women are crowded onto the sofa and the chairs brought in from the next room.
We're honored that you would choose us today. And what we celebrate is the marvelous fruit that you have borne. Isn't it wonderful?
It's a special occasion. Rosemary has brought her infant son for what would be a baptism if this were a traditional church.
I want very much for Eric to be welcomed into Woman Church.
Then Rosemary dips her finger in a small clay bowl of oil. She touches the oil to Eric's forehead.
Eric, my love, I anoint you and bless you. With your father, we have already given you the roots. I wish for you courage, because I think you're going to need it. And we will help you fly.
Eric is passed around the circle to every woman in the room.
Eric, sweetie, I anoint your eyes. May you grow as a person who is in love with God and in love with people. And may you be a joy to your mommy and daddy all the days of your life.
Eric Paul, I'm going to wish for you the gift of knowing that you are loved, because I know how one can turn into a wonderful human being when one knows that. And out of that, I promise to be your friend and to be intimate with you all the days of my life. And through that, I hope the wings that you will have are wisdom.
Welcome into Woman Church.
Although these women do not want to start a new church, they do want to create a new model for the church. They see themselves as prophets, a voice within the church pushing it to speak for the poor, to act for justice, to be a discipleship of equals, including women. That, they say, is the real message of Jesus. Women Church is still new. Most women's worship groups are only 4 or 5 years old, and the earliest began perhaps 10 years ago. So far, the church has taken no action against Women Church or feminist Catholic theologians, although other liberation theologians have been censured in the past. Mary Jo Weaver, professor of religious studies at Indiana University, says it is too early to tell whether the movement can remain part of Catholicism.
I think the early Christians certainly had no intention of becoming separate from Judaism, but little by little they found that they did. Martin Luther had no intention of becoming separate from Catholicism, but little by little he did. So you don't know where something like that would lead.
Mercy Sister Teresa Kane is more optimistic. She told members of the Women's Ordination Conference this fall that they had changed the agenda of the church leadership.
In Vatican circles, feminism was not spoken of even 5 years ago. I think it's extremely significant that feminism has become, as I understand it from several contacts in the Vatican, the most volatile issue in the Vatican.
And Georgetown University's Madonna Kolbenschlag says that the church has already felt the influence of the women who want to be priests.
the very act of women struggling to be ordained is part of something else that is also going on, which is a critique of the priesthood. And in fact, the ways in which women are coming together and ministering to each other is providing us with a new model for the priesthood.
Blessers, when I do the transition that has everyone extend our hands and bless this bread, blessing it in the name of every woman, I will then invite you to come up and just in silence, pick up your bread and pass it around the group. Any questions, bread blessers?
Yes. For the cornbread.
Yes.
There is no script. I think
I am recognized by the community of Women Church very definitely as a priest, as a leader of liturgy, as a pastoral woman. I'm certainly recognized at our local level by our own worshiping community.
Here are the ideas. Cornbread. Cornbread represents the indigenous people of this country, mm-hmm. the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. It represents the slave people. They ground the corn. This was
Diane New has left the Sisters of Providence. She lives near Washington, D.C., and she's writing a book of rituals for women. Part of her ministry, she says, is to revitalize the symbols of the church.
In some ways, I think the Roman Catholic Church has lost the richness of liturgy. And the real liturgical renewal is coming from the base communities in Latin America, coming from the feminist communities here in this country, because they are taking symbols seriously and are using the oil, the candles, the bread and wine that speak louder than any message that comes from words.
Moving within your daughters, moving within your daughters.
It is the last hour of a conference of women who want to be priests.
We are here to celebrate a liturgy of empowerment for ministry.
For a few days in a St. Louis hotel, it has been easy for these women to imagine being priests in their own church.
Oil is the symbol of the Spirit, a traditional symbol. We know it as the symbol of healing, the symbol of strength, the symbol of power. I invite you to take the oil, to bless it at your tables, to bless one another, to anoint one another that we may be strong.
And at each of 20 tables, 10 women take the oil and bless each other and send each other back out into the world.
I would like to, for us to bless that oil's from the earth, that we may appreciate our use of it in our daily lives, and that we might be like Jesus, always wanting more and more and more.
I bless your cheeks, that you may always smile, your lips, that you may laugh when things are hard, your forehead, that you may think clearly, your feet, that you may walk firmly, and the whole of you, that you may in fact remember the power and the beauty, the gift of God that you are.
God is passionate life, strong and vibrant in us as we
The Power and the Spirit was produced by Anne Bolin and Celeste Wesson, narrated by Celeste Wesson, and mixed by Lorraine Wilcox. Music written and sung by Colleen Fulmer, flute played by Ellen Schimmel. Editorial consultants, America Rodriguez and Mike Schuster. For more information, please write The Power and the Spirit Radio Project, 1503 Crittenden Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20011.
The Power and the Spirit was funded by the District of Columbia Community Humanities Council, the District of Columbia Commission on the Arts and the Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund. It was produced by the Power and the Spirit Radio Project, which is solely responsible for its content.
If you'd like more information and you miss the address, let me give it to you again. It's the Power and Spirit Radio Project at 1503 Crittenden Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20011. And you heard that documentary on the debate over the ordination of women in the Catholic Church here on Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 2 minutes to 4 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Tonight on All Things Considered, the latest developments in the bombing of a TWA Boeing 727 flying over Greece. The explosion ripped a hole in the side of the aircraft, killing at least 4 persons and injuring as many as 9. The flight, which originated in Los Angeles, was en route from Rome to Cairo. Also this evening, a report on why the Reagan administration wants Saudi Arabia to raise oil prices. That's coming up at 5 o'clock tonight on All Things Considered. Right now, we're going to hear from novelist Robert Stone, who considers himself a product of the 60s. He writes novels that crystallize the events of our times and their impact on the American psyche. He won a 1975 National Book Award for his second novel, The Dog Soldiers, which is set in motion when an American journalist in Vietnam agrees to smuggle a shipment of heroin into America. The novel is about the violence of the war in Vietnam coming back to infect America. And it describes the dark, almost psychotic side of the counterculture and the drug scene in the early 70s. Stone wrote the novel after spending 2 months in Vietnam with the intention of writing an article about the war. A trip to Central America in 1977 led to his third novel, A Flag for Sunrise, which is about 4 Americans in an imaginary Central American country on the brink of revolution. His new novel, Children of Light, is set in Hollywood, where a screenwriter hooked on cocaine and alcohol is having an affair with a schizophrenic actress. The novel is not autobiographical, but Stone has been pretty cynical about Hollywood since the release of 2 movies based on his books. The film WUSA was adapted from his first novel, A Hall of Mirrors. Who'll Stop the Rain was adapted from his novel, The Dog Soldiers. He wrote the first drafts of each screenplay, but he was unhappy with the final conception of both films. Stone is well acquainted with drugs, madness, and the search for transcendence, which have become themes of his books. His mother was schizophrenic. When she was institutionalized, he was sent to a Catholic orphanage. When he was writing his first novel in the early 1960s, he moved for a couple of years from New York to California, where he became a part of the group that was immortalized by Tom Wolfe as Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters. This group was perhaps the first group to regularly get high on LSD and adapt a lifestyle that foreshadowed the counterculture. I spoke to Robert Stone earlier this week. Before we talked about his life, I asked him if he thought there were any themes that unified his novels.
Well, I think one of them is the promises that people make or seem to make to each other and the ways in which they very often fail to keep those promises. I don't so much mean verbal promises as the process of appearing to offer to each other some kind of love or safety or refuge and the ways in which they just fail to come through. And the ways in which people choose to perceive in other people love or safety or refuge, and how they deceive themselves in that perception. And also, I think the difficulty of behaving decently by the day, let alone doing good, just behaving decently, seems to me to be much more difficult than most people realize.
You've also in your novels kind of crystallized certain political or social events of our time and have written about them in novel form. Is that conscious on your part? Do you see yourself as a writer who writes about your time?
I feel very much that I'm of the time, and that my work is of the time. I really find it impossible to stay away from politics, and since I can't stay away from politics, I'm bound to the time I live in, which I think is part of my responsibility in a way. Part of my responsibility as a writer.
Why?
Well, because I believe that writers. Of fiction itself is something that's necessary, and I think in order to make our way through the present times, we have to we often have to refract reality into narrative and turn it into stories so that we can examine it in much the same way that cognition requires dreams just to clean the circuits and so forth. So I think that working as a teller of stories in this particular time is you know serving the time and I feel that I'm doing my job, that I have a job and that I'm doing it.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your life. You had what strikes me as a very difficult childhood. Your mother, first of all, was schizophrenic. Were you aware that there was something wrong when you were growing up?
I was aware fairly early on that there was a bias between my mother's perception and reality. But I fairly early on began to try and cover for her. I felt I had a twofold job, really. The first one was to make my own way and figure out what was happening because I wasn't getting it straight from her. And the next part of it was to try and cover for her to some degree. So I think most individual schizophrenics and people who've lived with schizophrenics get to comprehend the shorthand, the schizoid shorthand that the particular person they know speaks. So I pick that up, I think, as easily as a child will pick up another language.
Did she frighten you?
Never.
How does she support you?
Well, she originally had been a school teacher in the New York City school system, but she lost her job when I was about four. And she made her living as a hand addresser of envelopes. For a while, she worked as a chambermaid in the old Savoy Plaza Hotel. But for the most part, she was either a hand addresser of envelopes or an inserter of envelopes. This was for mail order companies in the days when before addressographs. She had a very nice hand. And it was somewhat in demand to have attractively hand-addressed mailers. As a result of doing this for years and years, her fingers became terribly deformed and arthritic. Her hand was really twisted, completely twisted by it.
And you didn't know your father or didn't live with your father?
Didn't live with him. Didn't know him either.
Your mother was institutionalized when you were very young, and you were sent to an orphanage and then to a Catholic school. And I keep wondering what it must have been like for you to go from someone whose sense of reality was unpredictable, like you couldn't tell what kind of mood she'd be in or how she'd interpret things, to go from there to a basically authoritarian situation.
Well, it's difficult for me to recall some of these things in terms of their emotional valence on me. I think if they were painful to defang the recollection a little bit. My mother was very affectionate. She was scrambled, but she was affectionate. She really did not serve me as any kind of authority. I was very fond of her, but I didn't pay much attention to what she said. So, I mean, I was an ill-disciplined small child because I really was getting, you know, I was sort of in charge of myself. The impression I got when I was five, when I went into St. Anne's, was that of being hit. This was done by the Maris brothers, I think, in all innocence. I mean, they were not sophisticated individuals. Many of them were first and second generation French Canadians. Their attitude was, I theologically, I guess, describable as Jansenism of a sort. They did believe in hitting little children. I mean, not sadistically, particularly in most cases, but they did slap you around all the time. So I brought that with me right into adult life until I found myself in the Navy many years later, and it took me an awful lot of discipline and conditioning of myself not to cringe when people yelled at me, I developed a kind of a instinctive cringe. It's very hard to feel good about yourself when you tend to cringe. So I really had to, that was an aspect of my reactions that I had to work on, and that's something I picked up in that place. Also, I picked up, I think, a knack for getting on with a whole lot of different sorts of people. Place like that, whether it's a ship or a prison, a boarding school, an orphanage, I mean, is some kind of zoo. I mean, this anthropoid, this simian